It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, last week, the Obama administration announced what it's calling the proposed Outer Continental Shelf Oil and Gas Leasing Program for 2012 through 2017. This program, according to the Obama administration's language, will advance safe and responsible domestic energy exploration and production by offering substantial acreage for lease in regions with known potential for oil and gas development. Well, where are these regions? Here is a list: the Western Gulf of Mexico, Central Gulf of Mexico, Eastern Gulf of Mexico, two areas in the Arctic, the Beaufort Sea and Chukchi Sea, and Cook Inlet. Excluded from this proposal are the coastal regions of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, where they touch the United States. Well, we're going to talk about this policy and what it means going forward and get some reaction. We'll also want to be hearing from you as well. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I have two guests with me this morning, Bob Deans, Associate Director of Communications, Natural Resources Defense Council, and co-author of In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction, and Michael Jasny, Senior Policy Analyst, also with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Good morning, gentlemen, and thanks for being with me this morning.
Thank you, John.
Good morning.
Well, Bob Deans, let's start with you. Give me your initial reaction to the Obama administration's proposal for this offshore oil exploration program.
Well, John, of course, we're happy that the Atlantic seaboard is off the table, certainly after what we saw in the Gulf of Mexico last year, 180 million gallons of toxic crude oil pouring into the Gulf of Mexico. We don't want to see that anywhere between the waters of Cape Cod and Miami, Florida. So the eastern seaboard, without a doubt, needs to be off the table, and we're glad it is. Equally glad that the Pacific is off. Where we have problems is in the Gulf of Mexico. There is a huge amount of ocean there that would be opened up to exploration, deep water exploration, that moves the drills over closer toward that western part of Florida. Critical fisheries, critical for tourism, don't need to be drilling there right now until we can improve safety and learn those lessons from the BP blowout. The second big concern we have is allowing drilling up north of Alaska there in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. We sat here for 5 months as a nation and watched this industry helpless to end that blowout in the Gulf of Mexico under fair skies, calm seas, and warm water. Imagine what would happen if we had a similar blowout in an area where the ocean is iced in 8 months out of the year. We have a lot of darkness, there's gale force winds, seas of 20 feet, typical, common, and temperatures 8 below zero with the chill factor by September. How on earth are we going to contain an oil spill in that kind of a harsh environment? We don't have the equipment, we don't have the know-how, we don't have the experience to do it. And until we do, we shouldn't be drilling in that area.
Michael Jasny, can you maybe take us inside the Obama administration a little bit with your policy analyst hat on and talk about how this policy came to be and what's behind it?
Well, sure. I mean, it's in some ways an attempt to thread a needle. The administration clearly wanted to keep oil and gas development off the Pacific, where there is a very strong objection from coastal states to any kind of oil and gas activity. And they wanted to take some time with the Atlantic as well, as my colleague Bob says. But unfortunately, they are opening up the spigots, as it were, in the Arctic, and also making more of the Gulf of Mexico a real sacrifice zone to this highly destructive industry.
Well, according to their language, it says the proposed program is informed by lessons learned from the Deepwater Horizon tragedy and reforms that have been implemented to make offshore drilling safer and more environmentally responsible and to ensure that we are better prepared in case a blowout or oil spill occurs. And there's a link to a website where you can go and find out more about what it is they mean by that. Have we not learned anything from Deepwater Horizon? And have we not made any safety improvements? Is undersea oil exploration as dangerous as it ever was? Or are we, in fact, getting better at it? And Bob Deans, why don't you go first? And I want to hear from both of you on this.
Sure. It's a mixed answer. Congress, shockingly, John, has not passed a single piece of legislation to make deep water drilling, offshore drilling at all, one iota safer. It has not passed one single piece of legislation through Congress to do that. What has happened instead is we've had a reorganization within the Department of Interior of the agency that oversees offshore drilling. And so they have split up into one agency now that covers the environmental aspects and another that deals with the leases and the safety. We think they should have gone further on that, but it's a step in the right direction. What they have also done is to strengthen the regulations a little bit to take into account some of the lessons learned. For example, one of the critical problems with the BP blowout was that the cement that goes around the tube to seal that hole that's been drilled in the ground wasn't properly tested. They skipped that step. They no longer have that option under the new regulation. So there have been some things like that. But, you know, really, unless and until we have some legislation that really puts teeth in this and provides the resources for the people who we rely on to do the job of enforcing these regulations, we haven't gone the distance that we need to go. And, in fact, we haven't even adapted fully the recommendations of the president's own independent oil spill commission that looked at this and made these recommendations. And again, the problem when you go back into the Arctic is, remember in the Gulf of Mexico, we had the resources of the Coast Guard, the Navy. The Gulf of Mexico is the epicenter of the offshore oil industry, so you had the industry's own resources down there, ships. And of course, you had the fishing fleet down there that could go out and help with the cleanup and containment operations. None of that exists in the Arctic. And in fact, the nearest Coast Guard station down in Kodiak, Alaska, is a five-day journey by cutter to this area where the drilling would be done. It's a reckless gamble. It's irresponsible. We shouldn't be doing it.
Michael Jasny, I'd like to get your take on this as well.
You know, that's exactly right. And as Bob says, the Arctic presents a particular challenge. You know, the Obama administration could have said that there might be a conditional development of the Arctic, provided that certain standards are met, provided that industry could show that it could recover a very high percentage of any spilled oil from the Arctic within a short period of time. That would establish a standard that could drive technology and that could ensure that any kind of development that ultimately took place had some assurance of safety behind it. But they didn't. Instead, what they said is that in 3 or 4 years, toward the end of the next 5-year planning cycle, there will be leasing and additional development and production in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, and that seems to us not embracing the results of its own commission report or the obvious implications of the BP blowout for the Arctic.
800-486-8655 is the phone number to call to join our conversation, and I welcome those calls. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. There's a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page as well, and you can leave a comment there. That's also a great way to get in touch. 800-486-8655. What do you think about what was announced last week? I know this kind of got lost in all the presidential politics and all the international news, and there's so much out there. This story did not get a ton of play in the media, but we're talking about it now, and we invite you to give us your input. 800-486-8655. The oil industry says that we have a big opportunity that we don't want to lose here to add jobs and revenue. And certainly with unemployment sticking at 9%, anytime you mention the word jobs, that seems to be the trump card that overrules everything else. What about it? I mean, this is a country desperate for jobs. Gasoline is expensive. There are a lot of people who think if we apply additional oil resources to the economy that a lot of things will get better. How do you respond to that? We'll start with Michael Jasny this time.
The problem with that argument is it doesn't take into account the fact that we are effectively addicted to oil. We are spending a great deal of money and environmental resources in developing a product which is increasingly hard to obtain and is really at the whim of foreign producers. No matter how much America develops its own resources, what we need to do and what NRDC and other environmental organizations have been saying for years is to develop reliable, renewable resources that can serve as the basis of a new economy. There's no reason to think that our energy industry has to be at odds with our environment and with fisheries and other industries that depend on them. We can have both jobs and environmental protection and abundant domestic energy. We just have to shift our sources from oil and gas, and certainly away from offshore oil and gas to renewables.
And we're going to take a break here in just a moment. And when we come back, I want to talk about some more some things that are we've talked in general terms about. What's going on, but there are some specific aspects of things happening in the oceans that I know you both find disturbing that are related to this that may give us some perspective on what the potential dangers are of offshore oil exploration and recovery. We're going to do that in just a moment, but first we're going to take a quick break. Again, 800-486-8655 is the phone number, 800-486-8655. The address for emails is talk@wpr.org, and there is a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page as well that you can leave a comment on. We're talking about offshore oil exploration and the expansion of leasing. The Obama administration came out with a proposed continental shelf oil and gas leasing program for 2012 through 2017. Proposal was issued last week. We're discussing it here this morning and offering you a chance to weigh in on it as well and wondering what you think. Do we need, a lot of people think we need more oil. Others think that we need to get off the oil addiction that this country is on. Wondering where you are on this and if you think we need more offshore oil exploration or maybe less. 800-486-8655. Is the phone number. My two guests, Bob Deans, Associate Director of Communications at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Michael Jasny, Senior Policy Analyst at the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 21 minutes past 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Today, coming up later on the Ideas Network, dignity is easily understood, but for many of us, extremely difficult to define. But that's the topic this afternoon on Ben Maron's program on At Issue after 5 o'clock today, the role dignity plays in our everyday lives. We're talking this hour about the Obama administration's announcement last week for a 5-year plan for offshore oil drilling, wondering what you think. And my two guests, Bob Deans, Associate Director of Communications with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's co-author of In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction. And Michael Jasny, Senior Policy Analyst, Natural Resources Defense Council. Bob Deans, tell us about what's happening, what's going on with the dolphins, and I know that there's a kind of a canary in the coal mine aspect to this whole thing, but we've seen some problems with dolphins in, I believe, in the Gulf and other areas related to oil exploration. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, be happy to. In fact, John, if you don't mind, with your permission, I will kick that one to Michael Jasny because he is really our expert on that. But I would like to tighten up one thing, one answer to your question on the jobs picture, which is a lot of people don't realize when you listen to the oil companies going around talking about how difficult it is to do their jobs, you would think that we weren't drilling in this country. We are going to drill 25,000 oil wells in this country this year. That's a 50% increase from where we were just 3 years ago. In other words, since President Obama took office, drilling in this country is up 50%. Hiring for that drilling is up 12%. So when the oil companies talk about jobs, they're really talking about profits, because who's winning the game when work is up 50% and workers are up 12? That's profits. The oil companies have made $100 billion in profits in the first 9 months of this year alone. Profits are way up, 40% for Exxon, 40% for Shell, 75% for BP, 100% for Chevron. They're doing more with less. Nothing wrong with that. But don't then turn around and say we're going to put the environment at risk for the sake of jobs. That's not what's happening. It's about profits. And I think Michael's your best man on the dolphins.
Michael, go ahead.
Well, sure. Well, you know what? There is a bit of a sense last year after the spill was contained that the story was over, that the Gulf wasn't in any kind of long-term peril now that the oil had stopped flowing. But in fact, that's not the case. And what we have seen since then is that some species are clearly showing signs of severe environmental stress. Bottlenose dolphins, which are perhaps the most charismatic species in the northern Gulf, they're the source of real dolphin watching tourist industry in many Gulf towns. They really seem to be suffering. They're experiencing what is really an unprecedented die-off since April 2010. The numbers of dolphin mortalities have been each month several times higher than they would be in ordinary years, and that number, while it's fluctuated, sometimes really spiking high like during the calving season, when many stillbirths and neonates were found dead along the shores, that number has not come back to normal. The duration of this mass mortality, the magnitude of it is simply unprecedented.
And do we have any really specific idea of what's causing this?
No, it's given the difficulty that the biologists have to assay for oil compounds, given the many ways that a big spill like the Deepwater Horizon can be affecting the dolphins. The exact mechanism isn't clear, but something is clearly going on. Scientists have recently found indications of Brucella, which is a kind of bacterial infection in the bodies of several of the dolphins that turned up dead in the last several months. This is extremely unusual, and it suggests that some other cause is clearly playing a role. The Deepwater Horizon is the obvious culprit. Whether it's affecting the ability of animals to feed, to get enough prey, or whether it is causing a bioaccumulation of toxics in the tissue of these animals, which is weakening them and making them more susceptible to bacterial infection. That's I think the latest thinking. In the case of the Exxon Valdez, the terrible thing is that impacts like these began to unfold months or even years after the incident itself, and entire populations were lost at a real remove from the initial spill.
800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We still have space for you. Callers are starting to accumulate. We'll take some calls in just a moment. Before we go any further with that, though, Michael Jasny, I wanted you to talk a little bit about some other things related to exploration. One of the things that's happening now, or is maybe it isn't happening yet, but one of the ways that companies explore for oil is they do surveying, and there are some there are some environmental questions about how these surveys take place and some of the methods. Maybe you could talk about that for just a moment, and then we're going to take some calls.
Sure. I mean, this is a really big issue. Oil and gas companies typically explore for some bottom deposits by using what are known as seismic air guns. These are arrays of high-volume air guns that are towed behind vessels and that sound in tandem every 10 to 12 seconds or so. They put out enormous amounts of sound, what one biologist has described as the biggest acoustic assault on the oceans short of actual naval warfare. These levels of sound have a tremendous environmental footprint. They've been shown to disrupt foraging in whales, to cause endangered whales to desert areas of oceans, the size of Texas. They've been shown to disrupt fish and fishing over areas the size of Rhode Island. So this is a technique which is not benign, is done at the front end before oil and gas production takes place, and may very well be the largest impact of the offshore industry short of a cataclysmic spill.
All right. We have some callers who want to join us, and let's start in Wausau and hear from Louis first. Louis, good morning.
Yes, hello. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm an engineer with 30 years' experience in the oil industry. Some quick comments. The total potential for all offshore production is about 500,000 barrels a day. We import 10 million. Isn't that significant? Gasoline prices are cheap if you consider both inflation and purchasing power. A good place would be $5 a gallon. Jobs, the oil and gas industry, like all mature big industries, are net eliminators of jobs through a productivity increase. Let's see, there is no possibility that we would ever attain oil independence or have much of an effect on prices at the pump through drilling in this country. And here in the U.S., we have two-thirds of all the rigs in the world operating. I think every man, woman, child, dog, cat who knows how to work on a rig is working. And that's two-thirds, 60-some percent of the rigs, whereas we only do 7% of the world's production. And those are my comments. Perhaps I should stay on the line in case you want to interrogate me.
Well, let's have our guests have a chance to chew on that quite a bit to talk about there. Bob Dean, so what is the potential for oil in these areas that we're proposing, the Obama administration's proposing to explore?
Well, I think Louis has it more or less right. We did have a record production in the Gulf of Mexico last year of 1.6 million barrels per day. That's about what we're producing now in the Gulf of Mexico. And that is about a third of our domestic production. Domestic production is up to about 5.6 million barrels per day nationwide. That's the highest level since 2003, by the way, but it is nowhere near the 9.5 million barrels a day we were producing back in the 70s. The fundamental issue here is that the cheap, easy finds that began with Spindletop a little more than a century ago in Beaumont, Texas, are gone in this country, and we are going to deeper waters, riskier places, more hostile environments, and we're putting more and more of our planet at risk to get the oil that we need, 19 million barrels per day in this country, enough to fill the Empire State Building three times a day. That's how much oil we're using. And as Michael said, the long-term answer is to do what presidents going back to Richard Nixon have been asking us to do, reduce our reliance on oil, move to cleaner, safer, more sustainable sources of power and fuel. That's wind. That means solar. It also means doing more with less through energy efficiency gains, and we're not investing enough in that. We need to do more.
Michael Jansen, you want to add anything to that?
I think both the caller and Bob have got it exactly right. I mean, there is the big growth potential in the energy sector really is in renewables and green technology, and that's where the investment needs to be made.
Well, am I still on the line?
Yes, you are.
One more comment. The only thing we can do to have any effect, say, in the next about 10 years is conservation, and there is the possibility of a 30% reduction in oil use through conservation.
And, right, and the good news there is that we've been moving in the right direction. In the last 6 years, we have reduced our oil consumption in this country 9%. We need to keep moving in that direction, as Louis says.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks, Louis. Appreciate the call. I want to follow up on something that that Louis's call reminded me of, and that is in the last election and in the last presidential election, one of the things that came up was drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge up in Alaska. And one of the stories that came out then, or one of the, maybe it was a comment, was that even if we went in and we developed that oil field, that oil wouldn't ultimately end up in the United States anyway. Do we have any guarantee that if we go into the Arctic and do exploring and we find oil and actually get it to the surface safely and move it out of there, that that oil will end up in the United States?
I'll take a shot at it. Oil is a global commodity, and it goes where it's most efficient for it to go, and there is no guarantee that a market would stay in the United States and not be going to China or India, or that it would impact world oil prices in any significant way, because we know what impacts oil prices globally tends to be any kind of a security shock. The oil prices have gone up to close to $100 a barrel in the last few weeks on fears of some kind of an attack against Iran over its nuclear issue. Those are the kinds of things that are moving oil prices. And the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is an example of a place that we have made a series of decisions in this country, as the entire country, going back to Teddy Roosevelt, that we were going to set aside certain special places so that our children would be able to appreciate the natural splendor of this country. It's a promise we've made to our children. We're going to keep that promise.
Michael Jasny, you want to comment on that, or shall we move on?
Yeah, no, sure. I can just to add to this. I mean, what we're seeing up in Canada, for example, with development of the tar sands, is a real targeting of Asian markets. That's clearly a source of very, very high demand for oil, and it could very well be that oil that is produced in America's Arctic could go the same way.
All right, 800-486-8655. There's a space for you right now if you call, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's go to Eagle River next and hear from Candy. Candy, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just like to say that I grew up along the Gulf Coast of Texas, and I've seen firsthand the terrible damage that the oil industry can do. I have a kind of more general question. I'm wondering what the guests think of President Obama's performance so far in terms of his energy policy. Do environmentalists, you know, have access to him? And I know that he's talked a lot about green jobs, but it seems to me that he should be more proactive to keep emphasizing to the American public the need for renewables and the need for conservation. Thank you.
Thanks, Candy. I don't know who wants to take that first. Bob, why don't you start, and then Michael, go ahead and chime in when Bob's done.
Sure. President Obama certainly understands that the future of energy in the United States has to be to move away from these dirty, dangerous, costly fossil fuels. And he has been promoting the kinds of investment we need to make, not only in research and development, but also in helping to make public investment and helping companies to get out there and do what needs to be done to provide solar, wind, other renewables, and also efficiency. And as a result, for example, we now have a new standard. Cars are going to be getting by 2025 more than double the fuel mileage that they get right now. We're already seeing success. General Motors Cruise car that now gets 42 miles per the gallon, one of the best-selling cars in America. Ford has comparable models. But it really is a difficult issue here in Washington to advance the agenda because the Republican House is totally against this kind of thing, and time after time is voted 170 times this year. If you can just fathom that, 170 times this year, the House Republicans have voted to undermine some kind of foundational environmental safeguard in this country, and they're voting against the kinds of things that we need to be doing to promote the clean energy future the president is behind. So we give the president pretty good marks on that. He listens to the people. You ask about access. We kind of made our access to the White House last Sunday when about 15,000 of us formed a human chain around the White House to say to the president, no to tar sands in Canada, no to putting the dirtiest oil on the planet through the heartland of America, through our breadbasket, through the granary of the world, and going down to Texas. And the president a few days later made a decision, I'm going to put that off a year and a half, take a look at some alternatives, try to get it right. We think when we take a second look at tar sands in Canada, we're going to realize it's not in our national interest. So we give the president pretty good marks on that.
Michael Jasny?
Yeah, and just to add to that, you know, one of the overlooked ways in which the Obama administration has really been making a difference is on the level of the administrative agencies. I'm familiar with the Navy and its environmental policy across a range of issues, and I could say, for example, that the military has been doing a great deal to green its own infrastructure and indeed its own battle units. The Navy has been producing green battleships with hybrid drives, has pledged to produce the first green strike group within the next couple of years. They're producing low emissions aircraft. So we're seeing, I think, real progress that the agencies are making. It's just outside of the public eye.
What about, you've got people now calling for the resignation of President Obama's energy chief, a little bit of a scandal involving some loans to a California company trying to develop solar. I guess a couple of questions come from that, and then I don't want to take us too far afield here, but it does speak to policy. Is that going to hurt this enough so that we really aren't going to be able to make much more progress in the near term?
Well, of course, as you know, the Secretary Chu goes before the House Energy and Commerce Committee on Thursday, where he's going to get quite a grilling on the Solyndra solar panel company that, as you say, went bankrupt this summer after receiving $535 million in federal loan guarantees. Obviously, that's a lot of taxpayer money at stake. We need to find out the facts. There are investigations going on, and if there's been any kind of improper conduct, we need people to be held accountable. But so far, there is no indication of that. And what we know that is not on trial is the concept that Candy raised about green jobs in general. There are 2.7 million Americans right now who get up every single morning, roll up their sleeves, and get about the business of providing this country with renewable power and energy efficiency, whether they're electricians in Pennsylvania, carpenters in Ohio, tool and die makers, steel workers, building wind turbines, putting in solar systems. This is exactly the kind of public investment we've been doing in this country since George Washington invested in the canals that helped knit our country together. And we need to invest more, not turn away because one single company is struggling. We need to remember that when 3 million Americans are finding an economic lifeline in tough time through green jobs, these are real. They're helping the economy. They're moving us forward. And it's more, by the way, than the oil and gas industry employs, which is 2.2 million.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Madison next and hear from Seth. Seth, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to pose a question and make a comment, I guess, to your speakers. And it seems to me that we have there's a couple different issues that are at sort of bay here. That we have a growing energy need, which is some people project to be over 30% in the next decade, and we have, because of that, oil companies, energy companies moving towards more and more unconventional sources of fuels, like natural gas in the northeast of the United States in particular, as well as you've already talked about, things like the tar sands in Canada. And so I guess I'd like to hear the speakers talk about how they view the new proposed plans by the Obama administration to open up drilling with conventional oil sources, even though they are deep water, and the environmental effects of that relative to gas companies and energy companies pursuing more unconventional sources. And then I guess the comment I'd make is that, I'm completely for and I support the need to have green energy, as I'm sure most Americans do, but the fact of the matter is, with increased energy and the fact that those still make up a relatively small percentage of our overall energy contribution now, we still are going to need to have oil as a source of energy, at least in the near term, while those other systems are coming online. And so it seems to me that some sort of restructuring of the incentives for subsidies needs to move in the direction of not subsidies for oil drilling and natural gas exploration, but rather the existing energy companies investing more heavily in those sorts of green energy sources. And I guess I'll take my answer off the air.
A lot to chew on there. Michael, why don't you start, and then Bob chime in.
Yeah, well, first on the first point about comparing offshore oil and gas development to development of unconventional sources, I would consider some offshore oil and gas development to essentially be unconventional. If you're talking about development in 5,000 meters of water in the Gulf of Mexico, or if you're talking about oil development in the Arctic in areas that are covered with sea ice, a substantial part of the year, and where the oil is essentially irrecoverable once it spills, that is highly risky activity, really on the frontiers of energy production in this country or elsewhere, and it needs to be recognized as such. And then on the second point, I completely agree with the caller about the need to shift incentives and shift subsidies. Even now, in Congress, we see not only a defense primarily by Republicans of existing billions of dollars of subsidies for the oil and gas industry, but even in some cases, in some pieces of proposed legislation, a push to extend those subsidies. We were talking a little while ago, for example, about seismic exploration, which is an enormously impactful activity that's involved in offshore oil and gas. Well, I mean, there's legislation on the Hill that would increase public subsidies of that activity. So it's remarkable that we have to say this, but there should be a real full stop to the expansion of subsidies for oil and gas, and a shift of subsidies incentives to renewables, as the caller said.
Bob Deans?
Those subsidies, by the way, are going to be worth $46 billion over the next 10 years, according to the White House Office of Management and Budget, to an industry that started the year before the Civil War. We've been drilling for oil in this country for 151 years. And we're not going to change that overnight, but over time we can. We need to be about the business of doing so. We're impeded and slowed from doing so by an oil industry lobby in this town, Washington, where I am, where 700 people get up every morning and walk up to Capitol Hill, seeing what they can do to make the world safe for the shareholders of the big oil companies. They have spent $400 million lobbying in Washington alone over just the past 3 years. That's the kind of firepower you're up against when you're trying to change. Now, remember, as you said, Seth, solar and wind right now are only providing about 4% of our electricity. But when you stop and think where we came from just a few years ago, we can now power a city with as many homes as Philadelphia in this country with solar power. That's a big gain. It's something to build on. And when you think that we're getting 4% of our electricity from those sources, we're only getting 20% of our electricity from nuclear after 60 years of subsidies that are beyond imagination. Trillions of dollars we invested in the nuclear program in this country during the Cold War. Of course, the nuclear power industry is a spinoff from that, and we still subsidize every single nuclear plant in this country, not only in its construction, but we, the taxpayers, are underwriting the risk of a catastrophic disaster at any of those places because no private insurance company will take on the insuring against a catastrophic disaster at any of the more than 100 reactors we have around this country. So that is exactly what we need to begin to shift in this country.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and see how many phone calls we can take before 11 o'clock. But when we come back, I've got kind of an odd question that came to me in an email from someone who saw that I was going to have this topic on this morning, and I want to pose that before we move on. We're talking about last week's announcement by the Obama administration of a new gas leasing program for the Outer Continental Shelf for oil and gas for 2012 through 2017. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:48. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest this hour to talk about the new program announced last week by the Obama administration, Bob Deans, Associate Director of Communications with the Natural Resources Defense Council, co-author of In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction, and Michael Jasny, Senior Policy Analyst of the Natural Resources Defense Council. All right, gentlemen, someone who knew I was coming, going to be hosting today and what our topic was at 10 o'clock fired off a question late last night and posed something which is kind of a three-rail bank shot, I guess, in a way. What if we change tax law in the United States to tax capital gains at a regular income rate? Right now, I believe it's 15%. But if it was taxed at regular income, for most of the people receiving capital gains, it'd be much higher. The point that my email correspondent made was that this would remove a lot of money from speculation and might have a positive impact on energy policy. I'm not quite sure how that fits together, but I thought I'd throw that out there just because, it was outside-the-box thinking. And Bob Deans, why don't you take a shot at that if you want to? And Michael, if you've got a thought on that as well, we'll make this quick and then we'll get to phone calls.
Well, the quick answer is NRDC doesn't have any kind of position on tax policy per se. I know that the energy argument has always been that speculators play with the market in ways that creates distortions and throws consumers off, and that was part of the reason families wound up paying $4 a gallon for gasoline in 2008 when the rest of us were coming through the jaws of the worst recession since World War II. But we don't have a position on it. I'm not sure how capital gains changes would affect that. And, we understand that oil is a function of a global market.
All right. Michael Jasny, do you want to comment or should we move on?
No, I don't have anything more to add to what Bob said.
All right. Let's go to Holman next and hear from Wayne. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning to your guests. Are you there?
Yep, go right ahead.
Okay, John. We farmed for 24 years, and we still live on our farm. I and my family, I had three sons. They've currently now moved off the farm and are doing other things, but we still live there. Here's what we need on the farm and what my neighbors need to put food on your dinner tables, gentlemen. I need grease. I need hydraulic fluid. I need oil and copious quantities of oil. I need unleaded gas, and I need diesel fuel. You cannot mount a solar paddle or a windmill on the hood of my tractors. It just doesn't work. And so if someone calls up and says, well, they want to see $8 a gallon gas, unleaded gas, then diesel's probably going to be $11. What's going to happen is you're going to drive the farming and trucking industry right into the ground, and there goes your food supply. I'd like you guys to respond to that, please.
Yeah, I'll take a crack at it, and then, Michael, you can jump in, Wayne. Thank you so much for calling. I've been down to Houma, beautiful country. I love that whole Atchafalaya Swamp area. It's really one of the great treasures of the nation.
one of the things that farmers are doing, first off, your point's well taken. Obviously, the way we're growing food in this country today does rely on oil. We need to shift that over time. We know it's not going to happen overnight, maybe not in my lifetime. But we need to get about the business of beginning it. And what we're seeing, and I know folks in Louisiana hate hearing about Texas, and I don't blame you, but some of the Texas ranchers and farmers are actually saving themselves now by putting up wind turbines. It's generating 8% of Texas's electricity right now. I know that doesn't work everywhere. But what we're trying to do is say that fresh water, fertile soil, clean air, that's also essential for growing food. And one of the issues that we're facing in the Great Plains right now, when you talk about running tar sands oil right through the heart of our breadbasket, is imperiling 260,000 farmers and ranchers who need clean water, who need fertile lands. We've got to protect ourselves, and we cannot continue to go to the ends of the earth and put those kinds of resources that farmers and others need at risk to feed a national addiction to oil. We just have to begin changing that. Nobody is talking about trying to cause dislocations that throw farmers out of business, or price spikes that farmers can't contend with, or pass along in the food that they grow for America, and for that matter, for the world. But what we do have to do is begin an evolution so that your children and the rest of ours will have a future that they can farm for, and will have a population that is healthy and that can continue to support American agriculture the way it needs to be supported.
Michael Jasny, our caller, said you can't put a solar panel on a tractor. What's our alternative?
Well, Bob, I think, put it really well. The problem is that we've got resources that are harder and harder to get, and the amount of unrecoverable oil, even if it's discovered, is enormous. And it's only going to get harder and harder to recover as we push deeper and deeper out into deeper water and exploit the gettable field. So the question is are we going to begin to develop alternatives that will buffer us in the future and prevent the kind of sharp increases we've seen over the last few years in oil prices? If we don't start taking those steps now, then it's just a problem that we're going to be passing on to future generations and making farming in the future more and more expensive and economically risky.
All right, let's try and get some calls in quickly as we approach the end of the hour. We'll start in Three Lakes with Pat, who's been on hold for a while. Pat, thanks for being patient.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. I noticed nobody answered the farmer's question. we're all a bunch of about warnings and no solutions. And you know, I know where these gentlemen are coming from, because we do have a tremendous problem here. But the reason I called was in North Dakota. I was just there hunting in North Dakota for 10 days, and there's a tremendous oil strike in North Dakota, and some of the farmers around there that have oil in their property are saying that this might rival Saudi Arabia. Have you gentlemen ever heard about this, or is there any truth to that? Could you let me know?
I think
yes,
he's talking
North
about
Dakota,
the Three Lakes.
North Dakota is the center of a huge shale oil find, and it is experiencing an oil boom. There's a lot of oil there. It's important that it be done responsibly. And that is one of the reasons that we're now producing 5.6 million barrels of oil a day in this country, which is the highest level since 2003. So while some of these other areas, the easy finds are gone, we have found new sources of oil that are being exploited with new kinds of technologies. Our concern about that is that some of this shale oil and shale gas is being mined through a process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking for short. And we found that just within the past couple of weeks, there have been some places where this kind of thing has undermined the bedrock to the extent that we've had earthquakes. There have been reports around the country about this. Fracking involves putting a lot of water that is laden with a lot of chemicals, some of them toxic, some of them carcinogenic, and deep underground, where it can make its way into groundwater. So it has to be done right. And right now, thanks to some changes that were made in the Energy Act of 2005 under Bush and Cheney, these frackers are exempt from virtually all EPA regulation. We don't even know what chemicals are going underground. We can't control them through the Clean Water Act. We can't control them through the Safe Drinking Water Act because of those exemptions. That needs to change. And if people are going to be mining for going for oil in this process using hydraulic fracturing in North Dakota or anywhere else, they need to comply with the safeguards that were put in place 40 years ago to protect our drinking water.
I'd like to try and get a call in very quickly here at the end of the hour. Matt in Duluth, you've got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to call and better represent, I think, the Cooley region in Wisconsin. I'm actually from across. I'm just in Duluth right now, but I wanted to say that we don't need more oil. As someone who's involved with farming in the Cooley region, I think that we're proving to the world that we can do organic. We can move away from big agribusiness, which is, I don't know if it is, but it seems like it's probably one of the biggest consumers of gas and oil, and that we can move away from big agribusiness for our equipment, or I'm sorry, big oil for our equipment and for our fertilizers and et cetera, that it's being done, and that we're showing that it can be done, that we can get higher profits, that we can do long-term management of the planet and the earth, and that we don't need more oil to do it. I just wanted to comment and say that. I heard the last caller, or one of the last callers was from Holman, and it was kind of disturbing because right in the exact same area, we are doing some really amazing things with organic agriculture. So I just
Matt, we're out of time,
thanks.
But thank you so much, Matt, for your call. And Bob and Michael, we're in the last minute here. We need to wrap this up. What happens with this policy proposal? Is there an approval process for it? And we've only got about 30 seconds. Bob, why don't you go ahead and take that?
There are public comments and so forth, but this is the policy. It's the administration's policy. It doesn't need congressional approval.
Okay.
Michael.
Michael, anything quickly?
Yeah, I mean, there would be some opportunity for states to comment, coastal states in particular, and the public can comment as well. There's also an opportunity for Congress to do so. But as Bob says, I mean, when the administration chooses a course, there you
go. We're out of time. Got to go.
John, good luck in Green Bay tonight.
All right. Yeah. Chrissy Pease produced this program and also handled on-air production. Thanks to my guests, Bob Deans and Michael Jasny with the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.